Hello there, and welcome to the Thinky Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I am joined by Drs. Dan Van Voorhis, Adam Francisco, and Scott Keith. Dan was a guest on the show last time. He's back today.
Great to be here.
I have a feeling that we're going to try to have you more regularly on the Thinky
Fantastic.
Fellows now that you have some free recording time.
I'm around, absolutely. I'll say very briefly, I have free recording time, but if you want to check out the Christian History Almanac, which starts on May 1st, you can check that out. You can go to 1517 Academy. You can check that out, where I talk about the Reformation just like we're talking about now. And then also, there's a thing called The Soul of Christianity, and that's a show, and the season 2 is coming out. You can check season 1. So I'm plenty busy, but creating fun stuff for 1517, and happy to be here on the podcast with you guys.
Yeah, we have... You know, so many projects you can sort of subscribe to and listen to, and I love that those things keep getting more creative. When the 1517 originally was basically doing the hour-long podcast thing, right? Now we have everything from the Thinking Fellows, 45 minutes, Banned Books is about an hour, 30, 40 minutes in the Old New Testament, Christian History Almanac is going to be 5 minutes every day. We have the blog cast, which is, you know, 7 minutes, 5 days a week, and...
pretty soon after May 1st, we will be having, or on May 1st, 1517 will be producing 3 new podcasts every day of the week.
Yeah.
Which is amazing, just in terms of the amount of content that's being produced. And I'm not just saying this because I work for the company, but it's amazing to see how much stuff is getting made on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. So, check it out.
So that's a lot of fun. So we are still in the history of the Reformation. I kind of like Dan last episode put the Reformation on this, you know, century time block, and I've been wondering as we are farther along in the 1500s, hey, when are we gonna stop? When are we gonna say that's the end? And I kind of like your 1618 idea. So we still do have a couple more episodes to get through here. Today we ended at about 1568, 1570 last time. The year was less pointed. So somewhere in the mid, late 1560s and the 1517s, the reason the ending, we used to end hard on a year on some of these episodes, and the reason why is because we've, in the last two episodes, had less documents to end on, where we were ending on, say, things like the Small Catechism or the Book of Concord, or the Augsburg Confession or something like that. So we're picking up with people this time, and I want to talk about who Martin Chemnitz is, and who Jacob Andre, and who are we are eventually going to refer to as the formulators, I think we have referred to them as that on the show before, are. And we've talked about them as students, and now sort of their teachers are dead, especially with the death of Philip Melanchthon in 1560. It would be safe to say their final sort of teacher has died. And these are the Lutheran reformers, the second generation of Lutheran reformers are around. And they're dealing with controversy that we've talked about with interims, with the Peace of Augsburg, dealing with Lutheran states, but not all Lutheranism is the same Lutheranism in this period. Okay, so we have some controversies going on here that are going to lead to back and forth writing. It's between Lutheran states.
Yeah, and Scott referenced this on the last episode when we were talking about that tension after the death of Luther and Melanchthon, and how Bob Kolb is really the guy. I mean, you just go to his, just about anything he did is usually touches on this. And sometimes we talk about the Nazio Lutherans and the Philippists. We can really break it into a whole bunch of different these people versus that people, but it becomes the, you know, once the two main guys are dead, it becomes a scatter for, well, what's the tradition now?
Yeah, who holds Luther's reform?
Exactly. Yeah. And that is the question leading up through 1577, you know, with the Formula of Concord and 1580. But you're right. I mean, the two guys that are really getting this going are Chemnitz and Andrea. And they're sort of, I mean, not even they would, I mean, they wouldn't, no, none of them, rarely did they all agree on anything. I think that's one of the underrated parts of this. Mm. When we make people just a Nazio or a Philippist, or we look at someone and we say, well, he's just in this tradition, it's an interesting time.
There were people that weren't necessarily in either tradition.
Yeah.
That probably got lumped into one of the traditions. I said last week that I thought Amsdorf died around 1560. He actually dies a little later, 1565. But that's sort of in that same time period is when these later students really... It's difficult to operate as a Lutheran when you have two serious factions that are holding different universities,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
They're writing and acknowledging different confessions. I mean, when if you're a Lutheran and you're, like, if you're a Lutheran layman, you're probably, as far as our confessions go, familiar with the Augsburg Confession and the catechisms, mm-hmm. right? But there are officially more than that. You've got the catechisms, small and large, the Augsburg, the apology, the Augsburg Confession.
You've got the epitome, these things that
you
really...
The epitome and the solid declaration for the formula. But then you also have the small call articles, which we talked about, and the power of primacy, the Pope, which you talked about. But the funny thing is there's more confessions like circulating at this time, even within Lutheranism, that are sort of previous attempts to the formula to say, this is Lutheranism right here. And Magdeburg, right? There's the Magdeburg Confession, which is sort of famously coming out of that city of Magdeburg, which was they were able to hold during the Small Caldic War that never really capitulated. And they write a confession that's if you were to read it, you'd say it's a very Lutheran confession, but it doesn't hold some of the compromises that managed to come out of the Formula of Concord, which just means the formula for unity, right? And so that's what these people, if we're talking about people like, I'd even put Amsdorf in there before he dies, but Amsdorf, André, Chemnitz, and others, that they're trying to bring some unity to this very fractured Lutheranism. And we shouldn't pass over the fact that one of the things that seems to be part and parcel with being Lutheran is fighting with other Lutherans.
Yeah, I was going to ask a question. What is it in... I mean, I don't think it's just Lutheranism. It's Protestantism generally. How quickly it fractures and splits into different...
I think it's sola scriptura.
Yeah.
That's an interesting... I think I know where you're going. What do you mean by that,
well,
sola scriptura?
Yeah, well, I think that prior to the Reformation, if you disagreed on something, it was very... quote-unquote, easy to find the answer. Even if you were sort of a low-level monk or priest and you had an idea that disagreed, there's a higher authority and there's sort of a system of higher authorities that you could go to get the answer, and eventually you'd be told, hey, yeah, keep teaching that. That's in line with Roman or theology. Or stop teaching that. That's anathema and you're a heretic. After the idea of sola scriptura, it opens up in a way everybody being their own interpreter of the text. Now, it doesn't, the way it comes out, especially in Lutheranism, doesn't actually do that as much. And that's how we end up with confessions in Lutheranism, right? Mm. Say that this is what we've landed on over here. We think this is an agreement with scripture over there. But the fact that you and I can still pick up a Bible and have a separate idea to what the Augustana says or what the formula says or whatever, we can say, geez, I read that in the formula and I read this in the Bible, and I don't think the formula is saying what the Bible is saying. The fact that we can do that causes these sort of...
Yeah. Adam, I think, for me, I think of, when it comes to the broad medieval church, pre-Reformation church, sometimes we talk about it as a time of diversity without adversity, mm-hmm. because there were a lot of different opinions, and they knew, okay, don't poke
at
the hierarchy.
They knew how far to go.
They knew exactly.
Yeah.
We can fight this much, we can't fight this much.
Yeah.
When Luther comes around, we have to remember, and we can't say enough to Lutherans and everyone else, Luther didn't want to break from the church.
Yeah.
Luther was not out to start his own church. Yeah. Luther wanted to reform the existing church.
Do you think, and I've thought this a couple times, that he actually thought at the beginning that he was saying stuff other people were saying?
Absolutely.
And
he's saying, I mean, Huss was saying it, yeah. and other proto-reformers.
And in a sense, that even people at the time were saying. I mean, in some ways, he was early on, he's saying some of the same stuff that Erasmus is saying.
Yeah.
And that he's kind of surprised that it's like, why do people even care?
Well, and then when he gets pushback, he's like, okay, Augustine said it.
Yeah.
Well, this is, in the last episode, you mentioned In the Fullness of Time, right?
Yeah.
It just so happens that it is it's happening with the printing press. It's happening with a German celebrity. It's happening with Luther, who when Luther disagrees with you, it's a little different from Erasmus or others disagreeing with you.
Well, but originally, he's a no-name monk from a backwoods university.
Yeah, but he's got that. He's got what we call star power, Scott.
He's got some gravitas.
Star power. But, I mean, he's a guy who I think we...
Sparkly fingers.
We see him as rightly this giant. And, but you're right. In his context, he was just another heretic. In some ways, he should have been killed.
Yep.
In some ways, he should have just been left alone. The history of the Reformation is, why didn't those two obvious things happen?
Yeah.
And we get, you know, 100 years of
I think that especially early on, why didn't they just leave him alone? Like early on, but...
Because the Turks.
The Turks. There you go.
That's probably true.
Yeah, that's part of it, right?
Those because German stock soldiers.
You need the mercenaries. Yeah. Don't upset the Germans. He's their hero. Mm-hmm. And it's there are ways in which we just see Providence kind of putting all these things together. And it's fun to see the patterns that come out.
The reason why I asked the question is I heard, and I'm not going to name names or anything, and this is not me, Caleb, expressing or disclosing my sympathies with Thomism or anything like that. But it seems that the Catholic Church before, let's say, the Council of Trent or before 1517 or whatever, kind of pulled off ecumenism.
Can I add one thing that'll get us in trouble to that?
Before, yeah.
I do think that... the question in modern Lutheranism, that especially in the LCMS, where we're seeing sort of this tension between, I'd say, arguably Thomists and not Thomists, or what might be called sort of Scholastic Lutherans and not Scholastic Lutherans, is this idea that holding to sola scriptura really can lead you to ask some questions. That's kind of what we said at the end of the last episode, right? The reason study Bibles can sometimes be a problem is they ask the questions before you
have time
to think of them. Mm-hmm. But sort of reading the text and allowing the text to speak for itself can raise some questions that aren't always easy to answer. They're not always easy to answer directly from the text because the text might not speak directly to an answer and all these other things, right? But if you can say, oh, I'm sola scriptura and I'm confessional, but I have sort of these Thomist leanings when it comes to natural law and whatnot, that provides a definitive answer to questions like sexual ethics questions and things like that, right? Mm-hmm. It provides definitive answers that maybe aren't as clear and definitive in the scriptures as they are in sort of
in the system.
In the system. And I think it's an interesting thing to ask at this particular time in American Lutheranism because people are picking up on this. They're like, we need some definitive answers. They feel they need some definitive answers. And it's difficult to get them from the confessions because confessions doesn't... Confessions doesn't deal with homosexuality or transgenderism or anything like that.
Without naming names at all, just a general trend, I've seen with a certain kind of Lutheran... This, especially when it was Pope Benedict, this like love of Pope Benedict.
Yes.
And I thought like, ain't we the ones who don't like them the most?
You and me both, brother.
But
there's a story about Pope Benedict meeting one of the LCMS district presidents.
Yeah, okay, so there's an Illuminati story.
Oh, you're No. The district president said, I'm from the LCMS district so-and-so. And
PSW.
Benedict, no. Other coast. Benedict said, oh... You're the Lutherans we like.
Well, I have another story that's apocryphal. Right?
Okay, those are the best.
That was not apocryphal.
Listen, as an historian, I say apocryphal stories, they're okay. They're
but
the
NALC, the North American Lutheran Church, came out of the ELCA over the issue essentially of sexual ethics, right? This is why they're not part of the ELCA anymore. And their bishop, too, met with Benedict. And within the NALC, I think you can see a bit of this sort of philosophy, too. You know, it's kind of, let's get some grounding here in natural law if we can't get it in the scriptures or we can't get it in the confessions. And the fact is, I mean, you can maybe extrapolate to arguments, say, with transgenderism in the scriptures. And I'm not, for those of you who want to write us emails, like, crucify me, I'm not advocating for any of this. In fact, I have the opposite position, right? I think that these things are at best problematic and at worst sins, right? And at the end of the day, though, the natural law argument works much better for saying that's completely unnatural than anything directly out of the confessions or the scriptures or really, I mean, it's difficult. And sola scriptura opens you up to like asking questions. Where does the scripture say that? On anything.
And the question that, you know, we certainly are familiar with in the Lutheran tradition of where does the philosophy come in? Yeah. The worldview, the system.
Yeah.
Is it ministerial or magisterial?
Right.
And if it's ministerial, it can't bring... if we don't have a category for it, but it has a category, we don't have a category for it.
Well, and...
this is where I've...
give me a timeout for a second. Mark the time or whatever. Give me a timeout for a second if you need to cut this.
Okay.
Just know where we are. That's all I'm saying.
I got you.
It's easier not to treat somebody with compassion if you're able to say this goes against natural law.
Mm. Yeah.
It just is.
Yeah.
It's easier...
good point.
...to just deal... even if you think it's a sin, which I do... within that context of it being a sin, it's a sin like other sins, and that person still needs the mercy of God on account, and the grace of God on account of Christ, period, the end. But it's easier to divest yourself from having any compassion towards somebody if it's just simply unnatural.
Yeah.
What do we do throughout the history of humankind? We look at dehumanizing the other, right? We say that person is an other, and then we can do terrible things. And that natural law, what I'm getting is... maybe it's not as helpful. Maybe it's got some helpful things, but let's put some brakes on it and not just adopt it wholesale. Well,
it's why, to get at what Adam said, it's why I'm not a Thomist,
yeah,
to be honest with you. Because here's the deal. Those things are sins, but man, many of the things I do every single freaking day are sins too.
Mm-hmm.
And I expect, and in a way, I demand, because he promises it to me, God's grace on account of Christ for those sins that I commit every day. And I demand them without saying definitively, you only give me that grace if I stop doing those sins. Right? I demand them with the expectation that I'm going to commit some of those same sins tomorrow too, if not all of them. Because he promises his grace to me on account of Christ, even though I'm a sinner, because I'm a sinner. That's easy to do from the perspective of Scripture. It's harder to do from the perspective of natural law because it's just unnatural.
You know, when we're talking about and this splintering, Adam, we started this conversation by you saying we splintered into so many denominations, and how did this happen so quickly, and what is it in the DNA of Protestantism to do that? You know, and I think when we tend to grab these other philosophies and we're just prone to grabbing other philosophy, and when it is distinct from the gospel proclamation, well, then you can become as many groups as you want. It's interesting to me to see the groups that are coming together now, many of our friends around 15, 17 and the like. Even though we're not in the same necessarily church bodies, we're coming together around some of these principles, these Reformation principles, these things that came out, because we say, oh, that's what it's about. When it gets away from that and it becomes your view on natural law and your view on Old Testament interpretation and your view on sexual ethics, then you can split up as many ways as you want.
Well, we probably need to get back to dates, but it's also this is the original thing that Luther argues against in his disputations. He argues against applying, not philosophy, not like in terms, not in terms of reason, not philosophy, but philosophies that you think can answer the hidden questions of God to the Scriptures and to the gospel. This is the original thing he argues against right here. And it's what, to tie it into the date conversation, it's what later Lutheranism becomes more comfortable with doing, especially after the period that we're talking about now, as you get into 17th century Lutheran dogmaticians. They become more comfortable with doing that original thing that Luther warned against, which is applying particular philosophies to the Holy Scriptures in order to answer certain unanswered questions. And as good as, again, to tie it back into your date, as good as the two natures in Christ from Chemnitz is, which is amazing, it's, in my mind, it's one of the footholds of that. Because he, that's what's
78.
He has to use so many Aristotelian arguments to do that.
Do you think it's
a foothold for the start of this? Hmm. Now, he doesn't do it. It's much like with Melanchthon and the Philippists, right?
Yes.
Or Luther and the Gnasios. Chemnitz doesn't go too far with it, but that type of argumentation that's so long and so technically Aristotelian, it opens the door to the later dogmaticians who, in my opinion, I don't know about you, you've studied them, Dan, more than I have. They go... they go all the way.
Yeah. Well, I think
they just embrace the
scholasticism and whether it's coming from post-Trent Catholics or coming from the Reformed, there's a just kind of blending of traditions, which, who knows, maybe it was helpful, but at least we need to see them as things infiltrating other things. And certainly in that second generation of Lutheran theology, the Lutheran scholasticism, it's present. And I think we at least need to watch out for its ill effects.
So because he's absent, in the words of Rod Rosenblatt, Caleb, we will allow you to edit that conversation as necessary.
Yeah, no. I think it'll be edited. I think it'll be just fine. And I actually think I did the show
called Virtue in the Wasteland, and we rarely edited, so you guys will be fine. Don't.
Now I'm sweating. Can we turn on the fan?
May 1st, Christian History Almanac. No emails. No one's getting mad at that. That's just me telling stories.
That's funny.
Uncle Dan telling you stories.
Oh, I love it.
So that actually works as a really good transition into those two camps, the Philippists and the Gnasios, who, like you just said a second ago, kind of go to extremes and do some of the things that, Philippists, named after Philip Melanchthon, do things that Melanchthon actually didn't do in his systematic theology, and Gnasio is also in some instances going pretty far, rejecting the law in the Christian life.
Again, in the words of the absent Rod Rosenblatt, can I give you an example of that?
Yeah.
I mean, the classic example of, I mean, there's many examples of the Philippists going too far with sort of Aristotelian thought. I mean, that's essentially what happens as they explain the supper. You know, they parse, and eventually, in with and under, right? Christ's body and blood being in with and under the bread and the wine is gone because you've parsed so far that nobody can understand what you're saying. Mm-hmm. But the other classic one on the other side of not being aware of how to explain things or trying to explain things without understanding the philosophical implications is Flaccius or Flacius or however you want to say it, one of the classic Gnasios. Eventually makes an argument regarding how sinful is a person, and he's arguing against Philippists who are using Aristotelian arguments to say that you can sort of, within man's will, you can assign a part that does something good in his conversion, and they're using Aristotelian categories to say, well, it's the part that's changed, it's doing good, even though the changer itself is not the person, da-da-da, they're getting all crazy with it. And Flaccius says, well, that's nuts, man. A person is so sinful that they are sinful way down to their substance. And it becomes, the Flaccian heresy.
Yeah, did God create sinners?
Yeah, because...
In some ways, that is one of the premier, Lutheran... I mean, that's the touch point for the scattering of Lutherans in many ways.
Yeah.
And it's because, as you're saying, of these Aristotelian things that are coming into it and giving us a million different answers or possible answers or different categories, which maybe the scriptures don't even have that category.
Right.
Yes.
And the Philippists come back at him. I mean, the Philippist now is thoroughly trained people in Aristotelian arguments come back and go, wait a minute, you just use one of our words, you use substance to describe the nature of a person as sinful, which would mean, just as you said, Caleb, that God created us to be sinners, mm-hmm. which we know from the scriptures can't be the case. And all of a sudden, Flaccius is like, well, that's not what I meant. It's like, and this is where you get these two sort of points where I said, the Gnasios do things Luther would have never done because even though, as much as he spouted off his mouth, he was educated enough and careful enough not to step in that pile of turd. And the Philippists do things Melanchthon would have never done because they too, being more educated in that philosophy, yet were not careful with it.
Yeah, and too often, and I don't want to go off on another tangent, but too often people do, I hear Philip Melanchthon believed or wrote or did X, Y, and Z, and sure enough, it was Philippists that believed or did or wrote X, Y, and Z.
Oh, that's the history of intellectual history. Yeah. of you just have the person and then their ism.
Yeah.
And usually the ism is going to be decades, years, whatever, centuries after that person. Because if they've written enough, they've been interpreted enough, and then where they haven't written, oftentimes in coming centuries,
somebody speaks from their
someone says, well, I think this is what they would have said, and it becomes a school of interpretation, and you know, basically, we need to keep colleges in business. So this is how we do it. It's just a system. We've all been through it, right, guys? Come on. Now we're podcasting. So we're saying no to the man and that machine.
Now we're offering free education.
Exactly. Right. At the 1517 Academy, where we talk about the Reformation.
Mm-hmm. And the Augsburg Confession.
Exactly.
And Islam and apologetics.
Yeah.
So as I look at the timeline, something stood out to me that was funny. The Confutation is officially published in 1573.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
40,
yeah.
What, 40 years later?
Yeah. Huh. 43 years
That's
later.
That's insane.
Yeah. I mentioned that back when we did a show on the Augsburg Confession and the Confutation, is that they 1530, when they respond to the Augsburg Confession, they get up and they read this thing that's haphazard and poorly put together, and students are taking cope in, you know,
Wittenberg notes.
Are taking notes, you know, and on the basis of the notes, Melanchthon writes the apology. But they then promptly took the Confutation, as well as, by the way, the Augsburg Confession.
Which is hidden away in the Vatican.
Yeah. Hauled it back to Rome and never released it again. But finally, they got enough pressure, I think probably because of references from the Council of Trent, mm-hmm. that they publish it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
43 years later. I think it's funny.
That's pretty substantially late. I mean, we talked about, you know, only 3-month gap between the Augsburg Confession being presented and Melanchthon having to rewrite it. And even at the table, we were like, well, Melanchthon could have changed something.
As Lutherans, we don't say that.
Okay, but...
That's impossible.
Yeah, that's impossible.
Changed even a
but
word.
The amount of change to this document that probably did happen and is likely to happen in 43 years. I mean, the original.
Well, they claim to have packed it away and then just tried it out later. But
well, I think it's interesting to see also if we look at the context of what's happening outside of Germany. You can see maybe why some of the German churches and the Lutheran churches were interested in coming to some kind of conclusion, and or coming to some sort of peace or statement of faith. Because if they're looking around to France, the wars of religion have just started. If they're looking over to England, you've had the Bloody Mary, Bloody Elizabeth. If you look in the Netherlands and Spain, you've got Charles V, who had wreaked all his havoc. I mean, it's bloodshed, although it's not gotten to the point of 1618. It's becoming quite clear that that same impulse that led us to the Peace of Augsburg in 1555, which we talked about on the last show, that there's a real threat of physical violence, of war, and so people are getting together a little faster, saying, "Okay, let's put this together." Yeah. But then you've got the political and the theological centers, and the political centers want something, and the theological centers want something, and you know the history up until 1580 it really is a history of, you know, balancing not only the Lutheran Melanchthon and those schools of thought, but also political exigencies and theological things.
I love having political historians on the show.
I think the St. Bartholomew Day Massacre, was that 1572?
Yeah,
where
yeah.
at some wedding party?
Oh, it's Game of Thrones, Red Wedding. It's absolutely, it's all Game of Thrones. And I mean, the blood that spilled, and not just the blood that spilled, but the way in which the printing press realized, oh, I know it sells. And so it's whether it's Bloody Mary, Fox's Book of Martyrs, stories of the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre, which was interesting, but there were much bigger massacres. That one just got the pub. Mm-hmm. And this is the age post-Luther where that's a really big issue. And, you know, if it bleeds, it leads. That was true in the early days of news as well in the 16th century. And so you get that pressure, you know, and it's going to embolden the people from below. It was a stressful time to live. I mean, they didn't have Twitter and you know, streaming CNN 24 hours and stuff, but the tension.
What's Twitter?
It's online computer
stuff.
That's
social media.
Yeah, ARPANET, don't worry.
I actually have it on my phone. I don't do anything with it. But
so next major stopping point, the crypto-Calvinists in Wittenberg. What is a crypto-Calvinist, and do they plague us to this day?
Oh, gee.
Talk about leading with the question. Well, I think, you know, what is a crypto-Calvinist? Crypto just means, you know, secret, hidden.
Yes.
You know, and so sometimes it is that someone is a secret or hidden Calvinist. Sometimes it's that they have, you know, a doctrine or two which may veer in that direction. I mean, it's one thing to be one and one thing to be called one.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that there were those then, and there were those that were just called that then. Same today.
I would say probably most of the ones that may lean in that direction today don't know that that's what they're doing.
Sure. It's because when we talk about it, I mean, sacramentarianism, or we're talking yeah. about a view of the sacraments primarily.
Primarily view of sacraments that differs.
And that's what's going to...
Led by Philippists, who probably knew what they were doing.
But want to just, yeah.
Yeah, wanted to push the envelope a little bit. Some of this could have had... I mean, if you want to put the best construction on some of these guys, some of them were trying to make peace. Because as Dan said, the threats were getting greater as time went by, right? It used to be like one man's going to be burned at the stake, and now there's going to be a war over this.
Yeah.
And now there could be a massacre in your church over this. Mm-hmm. And so the threats are getting greater, and in some ways, people are just simply making concessions, without realizing that they live in such a confessional age, that those concessions will be received very poorly by people who think that it's not authentic to do so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's some of that we can relate to today. Like authenticity is sort of a big thing.
And I even think what you said in the difference between people who understand or take very seriously their subscription to a confession and the confessions as a whole, and people who sort of understand them, have read them, but don't in the same degree put their whole body and soul into subscribing to it.
It can lead to a tribalism, right? Mm-hmm. In this age, sometimes it's not even what you believe, but what team you're saying you believe with. Mm-hmm. And that's unfortunate, and it's not to be cynical at all, but it's just the way things are sometimes. And okay, well, you know, I think of when I lived in Scotland, and it was all about Rangers versus Celtic as the two soccer teams. And I was told on many occasions that that's Protestant Catholic. Now, none of them darken the door of a Protestant or Catholic church, but dang it, they were Protestants and Catholics on Saturday when the football was on, and they were, you know, pounding each other's
football,
heads.
You mean soccer.
Soccer, sorry. Yeah. By when they were pounding each other's heads on the cement or with a, you know, McEwen's lager tin. So even though they weren't the most theologically pious of folks, the party line was drawn, and people like a good fight and sometimes a good party line. And that's just one of the unfortunate things that we see as some of the very, very sincere and devout people were trying to figure out what's our identity. Well, and then you got the yahoos who just buy the hat or the flag and punch people up after the game. So, you know, it happens.
Cool.
The yahoos.
I don't mean to be cynical. I mean, I'm just trying to say we want to think of the whole range. There's no reason to think that, you know, think of your church today and think of the people that are into their work or into theology or not into theology or into their kids or not into their kids or into whatever. The church was made up of the same kinds of people back then.
Yep.
So we want to always, I find as a historian, try and look at everyone in the church pews and say, what's going on with them?
Yep.
And as much as we're interested in the sort of pure theological thought, sometimes, you know, it gets messed around with other things.
Going on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so I think this, where we are in time, this will probably get us to the end here, but now we have the Torgau Conference, the epitome to the formula, and the next year, the Solid Declaration.
I think this, so you're 1575 to 1580, kind of, mm-hmm. right? And this is kind of a fun period. I mean, I think it's a little earlier that, I don't know, it's like earlier 1570s that Andre takes his sermons on sort of the horsey trail. Or, you know, I kind of think of it with the circuit rider trail. Like he's got these six sermons that become part of the epitome, and he's trying to convince the pastors who will eventually vote on whether or not this is accepted as this document for unity. And so he writes these sermons. And he trots him around from church to church on probably donkey back, you know, just like
stuff that people have been doing forever. Yeah. And it's just our dumb generation where we can't because everyone's, you know, live tweeting it and stuff.
Yeah.
Like, I heard this one before. But yeah, they could just go on the road.
Yeah, they could write six
exactly.
And do it for years.
And he just preached them. And in the process of preaching them, you know, he does some convincing on these issues. Now, it's kind of funny because I'm the guy that'll usually argue that a sermon needs to be, you know, very gospel oriented, and you need to, in our day and age, especially assume that some of the people in the pews are not Christian and are hearing this for the first time and all this kind of thing. But he's out there, he's preaching on like issues on adiaphora, on issues on election and the will, and writing whole sermons about this and now preaching it. And I think it's kind of exciting. Like, could you imagine being him? You're tasked with not only writing these things, but going out and convincing these various churches by virtue of being a guest preacher in a pulpit.
Yeah. Workshop this around the nation. Yeah. See how it works. Yeah.
Kind of, you know, politically think of it like, what do they call those gatherings where people...
Like a town hall caucus or something.
Yeah. They're doing town halls all over the country. Kind of like in the age when our politicians used to get on the train and do...
Whistle stop tours.
It's kind of like that. And it works. And the weird thing is that it works. By the time you get several years later, as they start trying to put together official documents in the mid to late 1570s, they're expanding on what Andre had done in the six sermons.
The element, too, of having that theology touch the common people. And, you know, by not just having it in the university and sharing the draft with his pals, but taking it to a church where you had to say it to all the people who didn't care about this maybe six other days of the week or as much as you did. Mm-hmm. And that's something that, if you want to talk about the sort of genius of Luther's theology, it has that sort of personal touch, that earthiness to it, which is both Luther's personality and also his context. And the best of those Lutheran scholastics, or those, we wouldn't say scholastics, but that second generation, those that didn't go to scholastic, we see, they were pastors. They were church superintendents. They workshopped this on the road, not just at, Wittenberg or Jena or the like.
Hey, man, a 1517 city event coming near you.
Well, the other thing that I think is interesting, and this is sort of the nerdy theological point, is that I already mentioned that Chemnitz writes the tome, The Two Natures in Christ. He writes that in 1577 or 78.
Yeah.
I've always told people that if you want sort of the outline version of The Two Natures in Christ, go ahead and read, I think it's Article 8 of the Solid Declaration and the Formula on the Person of Christ, where you get things that are obviously out of what Chemnitz was already working on in The Two Natures of Christ that are put into sort of squished together form in the formula, and is very, very smart.
Yeah.
And really the best, Article 8, and then if you want the expanded version, Two Natures of Christ, the best explanation I think that you can get of Jesus Christ, true God, true man, your Savior.
When I did my Christology course, which was the first course I did in my MA program, my supervisor was sort of tangentially familiar with Lutheranism, but was like, you guys don't have a lot of, just books on Christology. I was like, well, that's
because we have the book.
I'm like, that's because we go back. And then I was like, no, we have Chemnitz's Two Natures. He's like, when was that written? I'm like, 1578. So he's like, you guys don't have a lot. I'm like, no, we really like that one.
Well, what
that's
are you
really going to
do? If you're familiar with the Two Natures, what are you going to write after it?
Like, yeah,
I don't really know.
It's pretty encompassing. Because
translating it had to be just a...
Yeah, yes. No kidding.
Just a bummer, man. seriously.
A bummer.
Well,
is that Fred Kramer or
because
Jacob Preuss?
Preuss. He does like Melanchthon does, where it's like Latin,
Greek,
Attic Greek. Latin, German.
And it's
Latin. How about a little French? Just, for fun.
It's like four Loci Communes long. Like
it's like 680 some odd
pages. That's
how
I measure books in Loci.
Yikes.
Fun thing about the formula, too. The formula is written in various places.
Yeah.
This had to be a document of unity. So it couldn't be like the Augsburg, where it's just written in Augsburg, or the small called articles, just written for a conference. It's had to be a document of unity. So it's written by formulators in various places. And we can identify major authors, but there are many people whose hands touched the formula, the Solid Declaration.
Yeah, it's harder to, like with the Apology, right? We can say Melanchthon, with the catechisms, we can say Luther, but we don't typically do that with this, which is why even on past episodes, and I'll link the one we did an episode on the formula, and where we kind of said the formulators, because you don't want to, there are some major figures here, but you don't want to just dump all the credit on them for the unity of all of Lutheranism.
But it's also why you don't say, in a sense, this is when the formula was written, because there's a process between 1576 and 1578,
yeah,
where you get the six sermons that are turned into the Epitome or the Torgau book, and then 1576, 1577, the Solid Declaration is being written between various towns, finalized late 1577, really adopted 1578, and then really adopted in 1580 when it's included in the Lutheran Book of Common.
In the real sort of, you know, Cliff's Notes version, you know, when it comes to Lutheranism, there are the four big dates, 1517, 1530, 1555, 1580. And if you know those four dates, those kind of take you through, obviously, 1517, 1530 is the Augsburg Confession, first confession of faith. You guys talked about that. And then 55, the Peace of Augsburg, and then that allowing for there to be, at least in this part of Europe, enough peace so that people could take confessions and theological statements out on the road and workshop them and not, you know, be under duress, yeah, as they would have been in France or England or you know, anywhere else just about in Western Europe. So it's an, and then 1580, you know, whenever I talk about the Peace of Augsburg, or sorry, the Formula of Concord, and I'm one of many who you'll just see 1580 next to it. And you know it wasn't written in 1580, but that's the year that people finally put the stamp on the version that's the closest to what you have now. Mm-hmm. And so it's just this thing that's
a really good way to say
going through in the 70s, but 1580, so oftentimes I'll just say adopted, you know, yeah, book number, adopted in 1580, and that's it. And those are my four dates for Lutheranism, and of course there's many more, but if you're just looking for the four beats, that kind of gets you to, you know, the
professional age.
I also
think this is, now I just go into nerd zone for 30 seconds. It's interesting to think of the things that were proposed to be included in the Book of Concord, too. A few of Melanchthon's other confessions written.
Bondage of the will.
Yeah. The amount of Luther that didn't make it is a fascinating story for what Lutheranism will be. Yeah.
The Loci.
Yeah, I mean, kind of wish the 1521 made it.
Could you imagine, though, how long the Book of Concord already is, like adding a Loci and the Bondage of the Will to it? It'd be several volumes. What they landed on was probably good, you know?
Well, cool. I mean, we're pretty much at time, so that's good. I just want to, we'll get to it next episode, just give people a hint. In the next 10 years, both Chemnitz and Andre are going to die, too, so it's kind of interesting. So even sort of that second wave.
We're all going to die, Caleb.
Man, I thought everything was going to be okay, Dan.
It is, but no, in Christ.
Thank you. That's great.
That's very good.
And so that's what we're going to pick up next time, and I don't want to, it might be the last episode next time. So thank you for following us on this series or season of the Thinking Fellows. It's been a lot of fun. I think we made it through a lot of history in a lot, and this was,
and the historians are shocked at how fast we went.
Yeah, Adam's like, man, I think we did this twice as fast as we should have.
Like I said, I've done it before in just four dates, so anything beyond those four dates, that's getting into it. That's, you know, that's more than most people are going to know about the tradition.
Well, if you enjoyed this series, if you want to see more content like this, please do send us email, send us questions. You know, sometimes questions, give us an episode or make it into a Q&A, but sometimes they inspire whole half a year worth of content from us that says, hey, man, we might be able to do a lot with this kind of thing. And it really helps us understand what you get out of a new series. If people enjoyed this, if there was something that said, wow, I'd really like you to take back up doctrinal issues because this brought this to a head or something, just don't be afraid. You can send us an email on the contact page on the Thinking Fellows website. You can send a message on Twitter to the Thinking Fellows page, Facebook as well. So any way you want to get in contact with us, that's great. And please do remember to subscribe. And if you would like to support our efforts, you can go to 1517.org. And there's a big red donate button in the top right corner. Small recurring monthly donations really do help us as a podcast continue to produce this show week after week. So thank you for everybody who already supports us. And if you really have benefited from this series, please do consider supporting us so that we can do another one like it. All right, thank you for listening to this episode. We'll catch you next time. Bye.